Welcome to Talk Dizzy to Me, the show that brings you a comprehensive look into the complex field of dizziness. Now here are your hosts, vestibular physical therapist Dr. Abby Ross and Dr. Danielle Tolman.
Hey everyone, it's Dr. Abby Ross, vestibular physical therapist and neuroclinical specialist, joined by Dr. Danielle Tolman, also a vestibular physical therapist. And today we have a guest on that we have been in the works of getting on this show. I honestly think it might be a year now. I'm not positive. It's been at least 6 months. Today we have on Dr. Bryce Applebaum, and he's going to talk to us about vision and vestibular dysfunction. He's been on several shows. He has a great Instagram account. I'm going to pass it over to him here to give you all a little bit of a bio about how he's in the position he's in and why we have him on the show. So Dr. Bryce Applebaum, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been so excited to be on this. You two are the queens of Dizzy, and I've sent so many of my patients to your social media accounts and have so many questions for you in terms of how you even just describe the vestibular system to your clients and patients, because I know my viewpoint, but I'm not the expert in that space. And clearly vision and vestibular networks need to talk to each other for life to be as successful and rewarding as we all deserve it to be. So I'm a neurooptometrist, which is a title that a lot of people haven't heard about. And I specialize in something called vision therapy, which is essentially like physical therapy for the brain through the eyes. And I am on a pretty big mission right now to change the way that the world is viewing vision, because there are so many hidden vision problems out there that most of the medical world doesn't know what to look for. And we're all looking at structure and not necessarily function. And, you know, vision problems are literally right in front of your face. But if you don't know what they look like, what they sound like, then they can be missed and they can prevent so much of us from achieving our potential. And so I'm trying to educate and talk as much as I can. I myself am a product of the work that I'm doing. And I have a quick story I'd love to share from when I was in first grade, when this kind of all started for me. And I remember I was on the soccer field at Cardrock Springs Elementary School, and we were playing the Purple People Eaters. And there was this moment I can remember as clear as if it were yesterday, where there's these three attackers. I'm the lone defender, and it's them, me, the goal behind me, and they're on a breakaway, and they're coming at me. I completely freeze, like my legs are stuck in quicksand. They blow past me and completely easily score. And I remember just feeling very lost in space, afraid, helpless, like I let my teammates down and essentially gave away the goal to the other team. And at the time, I had these visual developmental delays. So what that meant was I had trouble focusing my eyes, I had poor depth perception, my eyes really didn't work well together as a team, which caused me to completely freeze in these moments where I should have sprung into action. And that night at the dinner table, I had a complete breakdown where I, you know, was in tears with my parents, sharing how I didn't know where to be on the field or what to do, and how in the classroom I felt so lost, often having to ask my friends what the teacher's writing on the board, or even walk up and pretend to sharpen my pencil to sneak a peek at what the teacher was writing. Remember those old school pencil sharpeners? And so I was a reluctant reader, and, you know, I found myself flying through other subjects to compensate for my deficiencies with reading and with many aspects of learning that required vision, and really had this negative confidence, feeling like a turtle retreating to my shell in so many aspects of life. And so fortunately I was born to the perfect parents. My father was a developmental optometrist. My mother was an occupational therapist. And really not until that breakdown did they put the pieces together, realize, you know, the gravity of the situation, and really put a plan of action into place moving forward to help facilitate the necessary vision development for me to help me soar in life. So I continued, you know, I started vision therapy. I started sensory integration based occupational therapy every week. And in about the fourth grade or so, because of the consistent nature of all my treatment, my eyes, my brain, my body all finally started working together. And I, you know, this confidence emerged and I became a stud athlete. I developed interpersonal communication skills because I knew my sense of self and space, and really started to enjoy reading and turned, you know, this disability really into a strength, where I learned how to gain an advantage in life and because of my vision. And so now, you know, my mission is to make vision therapy more accessible, to make it more sustainable, to be on the cutting edge of different therapies so that people don't have to struggle the way that I did. And I'll talk all about what's involved with those as well. But I'm a product of the work that I do. And so, you know, now as time and our field has evolved, we can accomplish in months what happened for me in years. So grateful for that and grateful to be able to help others with these types of specialties.
Well, I think you bring up an excellent point in a couple of different ways. So a lot of people don't know that you can do vision therapy, that there is vision therapy, like physical therapy for the eyes, you know, in the brain. And it's very amazing and fortuitous that you have these parents that could recognize those deficits when you were younger. But I would imagine that there is a whole pediatric population that go undiagnosed and misdiagnosed because of these issues and just because of the lack of awareness around vision therapy and what's available. So could you talk a little bit about some of those missed opportunities and misdiagnoses that we might see in our younger population and how that affects our development?
Absolutely. And I think I'm so glad you bring this up because as silly as it sounds, healthcare kind of has it all wrong about our eyes. And everyone who's been to an eye doctor knows that eye doctors are solely focused on the pursuit of seeing 20/20 and seeing these small letters. And while eyesight's important, there's so much more to vision than just eyesight. So I would love if we can all start thinking about eyesight and vision as these separate entities. You know, eyesight being how well we can see, whether that's letters on a letter chart or a street sign with the teacher writes on the board in the classroom. And then vision being far more complex, being how our eyes move together and converge and track and focus and process information and really how we can derive meaning from the world around us and then direct the appropriate action. So if we think of eyesight as glasses and vision as brain, then vision problems are really brain problems. And there's so many treatments out there and fixes for these brain problems with vision therapy, with the right types of lenses and prism, with the right type of training to change the software of the brain, to change how somebody takes in the world around them and processes visual information. You bring up these missed diagnoses. They're also can be looked at as missed opportunities. You know, vision is our dominant sensory system. It should be what's guiding and leading. And it's estimated that in a classroom, over 80% of what a child learns comes from the visual processing of information. And even with that, you know, there's 1 in 10 at a minimum kids who have vision problems significant enough to impact learning. And when that happens, that shows up as trouble skipping words or skipping lines when they're reading or losing their place or words going into and out of focus and becoming blurry or double, and then trouble concentrating and losing our focus. And so often in the medical world, labels are slapped on behaviors, labels like ADD, ADHD, dyslexia, when in fact, these can be hidden functional vision problems that just show up very similar to visual dysfunction or visual skills that we haven't learned or developed on our own. So most kids who love to be read to, but really avoid reading on their own, or who are squirmy with desk work, or you know, seem like they just have trouble or they avoid reading or don't like reading, chances are they have a functional vision problem and one that's treatable with the right type of treatment. But in a classroom, it looks like that child is disengaging from what's at a desk because they can't converge and focus their eyes and having to rely on their ears rather than their eyes for what the teacher's presenting, or they're just not able to process input the way that they should. And so it can make it seem like they've got ants in their pants or that it's really hard to sustain visual concentration. And these problems are everywhere now, especially that, you know, so many kids and adults are being introduced to technology and screens so early in life before they're visually ready.
I like your distinction between vision and eyesight because I can't tell you how many patients sit on my treatment table and tell me, there's something wrong with my eyes, but I went and saw my eye doctor and they told me everything was fine. But I'm telling you, there's something wrong with my eyes. I think that brings up just a really good point that they're two very different things. And what your optometrist is looking for with, you know, using a Chanel, an eye chart or looking at your vision, whether it's 20/20 or not, is very different than how your eyes are functionally working together and communicating with your brain. I think that's a great point.
And it's important to recognize, I mean, eyesight is important. We all need to see. Eye health is important. But once those boxes are checked off, or once we get the right lenses to sharpen far away, eyesight is just a symptom. You know, it's a symptom of very often an underlying problem. If the problem is the inside and outside muscles of the eyes are not working in synergy, that can manifest as the more work we're doing up close, the blurrier far away gets. Or headaches or eye strain because of too much time engaging with a 2D device rather than using our vision to navigate our three-dimensional world. You know, so much is based off of what we're all taught in school and what we've learned from research and data from decades ago, when in fact function and structure have a role together, and we need to all be looking at both of those with any aspect of medicine.
Now, when we think about vision from a broader perspective and how it helps someone function from a balance standpoint, can you talk to us? You had brought this up that vision tends to be dominant anyway, but how about in patients with vestibular dysfunction who then tend to rely even more on their vision? Can you talk to us about the role in vision for those types of people?
Absolutely. Can I be annoying and ask you both, how do you describe the vestibular system to your patients? Because I want to take notes and I want to share my analogy and see if it makes sense to you. And then I'll answer, I promise.
Yeah. So when I talk to patients about our balance system as a whole, I talk about the visual system, the somatosensory system, and then the vestibular system, and in that order, because I always emphasize your visual system is your strongest balance system. It's the fastest way to tell your body or your brain where you are in space, where your orientation is, and if you're moving, things are moving, if there's trip hazards in the way. And then the somatosensory system comes in next. And then your balance or your vestibular system is kind of this sensory organ that's constantly taking in information in the background all the time. It's not only sensing if you're moving in linear directions, like in a car or an elevator, but it's also sensing angular acceleration of your head and communicating those head movements to your eyeball so that your vision of the world around you is clear and not bouncing as if you were trying to watch somebody walk around with a phone or a video camera. So your balance, your vestibular system is there to kind of act as your gyroscope, orient you in space, and kind of sense if there's motion. But it's kind of that third line of defense that should never be your primary organ that tells you where you are in space. It's just kind of constantly working and kind of working in the background to make sense of everything and put together a bigger picture.
I'm embarrassed for how I described it. But I say the vestibular system is the internal orientation system and the roadmap of life. And so I relate it to like when you go to a mall and they have that old school map where it says the star is you are here. And then it's like Macy's is this way and Nordstrom's is here and the food court's here. And the vestibular system lets you know which way is up and down and left and right. And it takes input from lots of other systems, but of course from vision, where hopefully vision and vestibular input are providing similar input that your brain can interpret and make sense of to know when you're in motion, when other things are in motion, and how to establish order from all of that disorder. You know, so much of vestibular disequilibrium to me is a mismatch between the afferent and the efferent, so the input and then the output, which is why so much of motion sickness has a visual component that's treatable, especially for those who get dizzy or motion sick when they're reading in a car or on a tablet or in the back seat. Yet when they're driving and they're up front and they can really open up periphery and be able to lock in centrally, it's way better. That's a clear sign that vision's interfering and can help. But that kind of intimate relationship between those two systems almost always gets disrupted with an acquired brain injury. And then we get the feedback in the car of things in front of us static and not changing position. But then our vestibular system, the switch gets flipped on and we get all this optic flow that there's motion around us. And literally it's like you're in a fun house and can't understand who's moving, what's happening. And then it just, the responses throw up and get out of this scenario.
Now, what you describe are situations where we might hear as a vestibular therapist and think, this patient may benefit from vision therapy. Can you talk to us about vision therapy, what someone would expect with vision therapy, and who would be appropriate for a referral?
Absolutely. So vision therapy has gotten a lot of attention, honestly, in the last few years, more so than ever, which I think is phenomenal. But we now have lots of different specialties doing vision work and calling it vision therapy. And so I think that can sometimes lead somebody to go down a path of saying, I tried vision therapy and it didn't work. Or for those with substantial head injuries, it kind of awakens the sleeping bear and then symptoms emerge, but then they don't have the tools in place to come out of that disequilibrium that's occurred. And very often that's because a lot of vision therapy is working on the x-axis, so this way, the tracking system and the oculomotor system, and that's jumping your eyes across as you're reading or following a ball in sports or keeping your attention on something as it's changing position. Absolutely, that's important and that's a big part of life, but so much of life takes place this way on the z-axis, which to me is the inside muscles of the eyes, the focusing system, that's called accommodation. That lets us know what something is. And then the outside muscles of the eyes, the eye coordination, that's the where system, the version system. In a normal healthy scenario, when a brain is functioning the way in which it's wired, the where and the what provide the same feedback that the brain can interpret so we can make something single and clear. So I think good vision therapy is gonna ideally be with somebody who's board certified in vision therapy. And that's, you can go to covd.org, the College of Optometrists and Vision Development. And that's the international organization that board certifies doctors in vision therapy. There's a locate a doctor section. You can type in a zip code or an address and it can give you a search radius for the doctors within however many miles you set for the radius. So if somebody has FCOVD after their name, that means they're a fellow of the College of Optometrists and Vision Development. So you can pretty much always be in good hands from an evaluation standpoint. But to answer your question for treatment and what treatment looks like, this isn't like PT for a sprained MCL where it's like, all right, you need a dozen sessions and here's the work you do. There's not as much consistency yet as what there needs to be for vision therapy. So I think any good therapy is raising to the patient's awareness what they're doing so they can learn how to self-correct and self-monitor, and giving them the feedback of what it feels like, what it looks like, the depth that ensues when the eyes are working together and the brain's turning on to that information and processing that information, and really establishing the new neurology, tapping into new neuronal pathways, or fixing the ones that have been damaged or severed from an acquired injury, let's say, but to really make it holistic to integrate cognition and balance and movement and vestibular input along with vision, because we don't use vision in isolation of these other systems. So I think the ideal program for vision therapy should be office training with home reinforcement, where usually the new learning takes place in office, and then the reinforcement of that takes place at home. And then, like any newly learned process, the more you practice, the faster you learn, the faster things become automatic and unconscious and efficient and habitual. And ideally it's with a doctor, and a doctor's overseeing the care, not just saying you need this and then saying, see you later, I'll talk to you when we're done with all this. But it's obviously hard to make that work in a lot of places. And, I think really so many of the people that at least we see in our office, more than half our patients now are head injury recovery, and a large portion of those are concussion related, but we also see people with eye turns or lazy eyes as an alternative to surgery to learn how to straighten their eyes, often develop depth perception even for the first time. A lot of kids with learning related vision problems impacting reading and academics. We also work with a ton of athletes who sometimes don't even have problems. They're more looking for areas of opportunity for enhancement and to take small percentage improvements in certain areas, which can lead to a pretty big cumulative effect. Especially if there's problems or holes, then you get that much more out of performance. So it's kind of like any type of good therapy, but for the eyes, but it's really brain more so than eyes that we're working on.
That's kind of what I was going to say or relate, is that your description of good vision therapy and good care sounds very, very similar of what we preach on almost every podcast of having individualized care that doesn't fit into some sort of matrix. It's not standardized per se. It's based on every patient, their functional deficits, and then how to proceed from there. And I have to say, This was a couple of years ago now, back when I was living in Maryland, and I came in. Sarah had introduced us when we were working together, and I had come into your office for probably about a good 3.5-4 hours, and I got to observe what you guys did, and it blew my mind. You know, I was still, you know, just a couple of years out of school and working with vestibular patients, and felt like, oh, like I use Brockstrings. I have a good idea of what vision therapy is like. And I have to say, it just completely blew my mind out of the water, what you guys evaluate, what you look at. I mean, I walked into your office and the first thing you had me do is sit down and watch a video about, misdiagnoses in children and how that affects their reading and learning and development. And then we went into what you do in an evaluation, which was absolutely mind-blowing, all the different things that you look at. And then after moving on from that, you know, really long evaluation process, how you brought those patients through vision therapy and getting to see some people working on different aspects of their care. Not a single person in that place was doing the same exercise on the same level, or even remotely, generally for the same thing. You had people on the Oculus program and working on virtual reality type exercises. Then you had patients that were simply seated and working on a very lower level of function and working on eye exercise using these different cards and charts and other types of Brockstrings for different exercises. And it just absolutely completely changed my opinion on how much I really knew about the visual system in relation to vestibular dysfunction. And then since that experience, I have always asked patients to look for specialists who were board certified if they were going to go for vision therapy. You know, in my area down Savannah and Hilton Head area, the only place that I recommend is up near Charleston, because I know that they have a great vision group up there, the Drazen Vision Group, where I know that they are board certified and specialized and really do a great job. So, you know, that's got to be hard to for everybody to find somebody like that, because you guys are far and few between. Is that right? It's not many people specialize in to this degree.
Yeah, I mean, in the D.C. Maryland area, there's 7 of us board certified out of probably 6,000 or 7,000 eye doctors. And even out of those 7, what vision therapy looks like is very different. And so that can be challenging at times. I was so happy for you when you moved, but so sad personally for me and for our patients, because there's different approaches you can take as somebody who brings somebody along a learning path and a therapeutic journey. And there's some who, you know, want to be as aggressive as possible. And there's some that want to just sit back and just kind of do as little as possible. And I remember your patients, every single one that I had seen that you had been working with, shared how much they loved working with you, but also how you really listened and tailored the approach and the recommendations. Not like you said, as this cookie cutter, but like, here's what you need to help get you baby steps better into a place where, you know, the outcome is back to your previous self or the self that you didn't even know existed. But I mean, you're right. This not enough of us doing all the work that you guys are doing or that we're doing as well. And I'm hoping to help change that and helping to raise awareness and train other docs. But we got a long way to go for a lot of that.
We'll make sure we link that directory that you had mentioned too. That'll be a really good resource for our patient listeners. For our clinician listeners, and more so vestibular clinicians, what do we explicitly need to listen for in a patient's history to consider referral, or maybe this is outside of our scope and we need an expert?
So I think the first thing is, you know, you're always going to be asking about who you've seen and who's on the team. But having somebody check a box to say they've had an eye exam oftentimes doesn't mean much. And it can be as simple as, like, for a child, I went to the pediatrician and they put a chart up and I saw the letters. And the majority of eye exams, unfortunately, these days are like a 10 or 15 minute array of tests, let's say. I'm gonna be appropriate here, and not looking at what's needed. So, I mean, I think a couple things that all of your clinicians can do right off the bat is, you know, take a pen or pencil and look at eye movements, vergence, and a cover test. So, you know, that can be taking a pen, holding it at midline. And for those listening on video, you know, moving it side to side, making sure there's no head movements, no eye movement, no body movements, no facial changes where they're like, oh man, I can't look at this. And then keeping this at midline and bringing it towards their nose where it should be smooth and effortless all the way in. You know, I think so. I mean, NIH says 20% of people have a convergence insufficiency. I think that number is probably double that now, but it's still a really high percentage. But so often that really just demonstrates that they have trouble exploring near space. And near space is when we have to engage with the inside and outside muscles we spoke about. That's for reading, that's for screens, that's for work, for school. And you can tell from even just a really thorough history and asking the right questions, you know, whether there's a functional vision problem. You know, if there's dizziness, nausea, blurred vision, vertigo when they're on a screen or when they're reading versus when they're not, immediate red flag. If there's losing their place, skipping words, skipping lines, not remembering what they're reading, rereading, if there's visual inefficiencies with reading, immediate red flag. If they get motion sick or avoid ball sports or use reading as a sleeping pill, I mean, those are all clear signs, again, that vision is not guiding and leading like it needs to. I think visually enhancing your treatment, I mean, I know you both do this so well just from watching, you know, a lot of your content on social media, but, you know, body movements with head movements and with eye movements and rotational movements and away from midline and coming towards midline and integrating both sides of the body. I mean, all the eye brain body integration techniques that we all use, you know, if that's eliciting symptoms, that's again a sign that vision is likely interfering. I know a lot of PTs will measure balance, eyes open, eyes closed, eyes on a fixation point. You know, it gives information, but also we want to really do testing that simulates the areas of dysfunction in life and where the struggles are. And I saw somebody today who has been doing incredibly advanced rotational body movements and eye movements. And she started with vestibular PT 2 weeks ago. She can't even follow something across her midline, a pen or pencil, without literally throwing up. And yet she's saying she's having to do these crazy cross body, all over the place movements, and symptoms have gotten that much worse. And, you know, I think there's, we all need to be communicating as best as possible. And I would say if you hear somebody's in any type of vision work or chiropractic work or even work that you're not familiar with, pick up the phone and call the doctor and say, I'm also working with this person. How do we maximize each other's care and work together? Because none of us can do our work alone. We need each other and we need this collaborative approach, especially with, you know, the people with these substantial vestibular visual disconnects.
I absolutely agree. And for clinicians listening, you know, you had mentioned a lot of the tests that you would do to look for deficits. And I highly recommend that you're going through and really paying attention to how a patient's eyes move during ocular motility tests with your H test, right? Smooth pursuits we look at saccades, we do look at dynamic visual acuity and convergence and divergence. Those are all opportunities that you should be looking for abnormalities, because that may skew and change what your goggle testing or bedside testing is going to see in your vestibular eval. So I remember seeing a couple of patients where they might have direction changing nystagmus based on their dominant or viewing eye, right? So that can change your results and how that's going to look. So you need to be able to look at those things, be aware of them, not saying that you have to diagnose and be able to treat them, but you have to be able to see them, recognize them, and know when to refer to the appropriate specialist to help your patient, because there is that big overlap. I can't do vision therapy. I recognize that. And I know to help my patient, I got to get them to the person that can handle that. But having vestibular therapy done at the right therapeutic doses at the right level in combination with vision therapy, I think is extremely helpful for your patient. As long as you know what you're looking for, you can recognize it and make that referral. So we definitely do a lot of the same things that we should be paying attention to, but I guarantee you that we have some people out there doing their H test, just making sure they can move in all planes of motion and not really paying attention to how smoothly they can move their eyes. If they're moving conjugately together, if they're able to report symptoms during saccades and smooth pursuits. Like all of that stuff is things that you should be asking those patients during your bedside evaluation. And then having that, that list on hand, we talk about multidisciplinary approaches, being aware of who's in your area and making the referral to the right people. So make sure you're building up your list of people to refer to include a vision therapist or a vision specialist in that area.
Can I add one test to, for everybody to add? So take a very expensive piece of equipment, take a pen or pencil, hold it at the patient's midline about 12 to 16 inches away from them. You can tell the patient, I want you to look at the tip of the pen and make it single and clear. And then as the therapist or doctor, cover up one of their eyes and you're going to look at the eye that's open. We shouldn't see that eye move at all. And then if we do the same thing, cover the other eye, we shouldn't see that eye move at all. If it moves, that's by definition a strabismus or an eye turn. And if you think about a laser beam coming out of each eye representing line of sight, if the laser beams are pointing on the same place, there shouldn't be movement covering. But if there is movement, if the eye moves in, it's because it was out. That's an exotropia. If the eye moves out because it was in, esotropia. If it moves down because it was up, hypertropia. If it moves up because it was down, hypotropia. But so that's a cover test. But then if you then do an alternating cover test, which is not just covering one eye, but alternating the eyes back and forth, we should see a little bit of movement there. If we're seeing any movement of the eyes going outward, that's a red flag. And if we're seeing any big swing of the eye moving inward or the swing in any position increasing the longer you're doing this, again, a red flag and shows that there's a spatial mismatch. They're perceiving something in terms of eye alignment in a different position than where it's located. And that's something that, you know, literally by looking at it, by doing a cover test, analyzing eye movements like you described and convergence insufficiency or near point of convergence, you're literally doing more than the majority of eye doctors do in terms of uncovering hidden that are no longer hidden vision problems that are impacting so many aspects of life. And we see now, we see a crazy amount of patients from out of state or out of country who come in for intensive programs. Some who even do sessions every day, 5-6 days a week, multiple sessions a day, not because there aren't other people who do this, but, you know, we can tell with an evaluation, even a virtual consult, whether it's highly likely that there would be improvement there, just like I'm sure you guys can tell hearing somebody's story. And when there's, when they're in a mall or grocery store and there's a sensory overload around them and they feel like they have to panic and get out and the fight or flight response kicks in, or you know, somebody's at soccer practice trying to chase around their kids and they just, it's impossible. You know what's not functioning the way it should. And then you can likely kind of guesstimate what the problem is. And obviously you have them in and then you confirm and then you get the right treatment.
Yeah, exactly. And we do that. We screen everyone to make sure we are a good fit for their care and they're a good fit for us, right? There was a woman that has been messaging our Instagram and also commenting on some of the posts when we say, what do you want to hear about? And actually a few people, and they keep saying, can you please talk about prism lenses? And I keep telling them, we're going to cover this. I promise we're going to cover it, but I want it to come from someone like you, Dr. Applebaum. So can you talk to us about prism lenses and who they're beneficial for, what they do to help someone?
Yeah, I just gave a speech over the weekend, and one of the Q&As after was about this, and it ended up being like a 20-minute Q&A just on prism. So we'll make it less than 20 minutes. So prism is an optical device that moves where something's located in space. So let's say somebody has a 20-unit eye turn, and it's 20 units, whether they're looking up, down, left, right, near, far. We can literally put a 20-unit prism, move the world to where their eye is, and all of a sudden double vision is single, and the brain can start using both eyes together. Unfortunately, so much of life doesn't take place in one static position, and there's movement and changes in positioning. So that type of prism doesn't always work, but it can be effective. There's also prism where, let's say, somebody has a stroke and their bottom right field is damaged based off of where the area of the brain was that was deprived of oxygen. We could literally move the world from down right up until straight. So now going up and down stairs or reading becomes so much easier because they're jumping their eyes not into no man or no woman's land. They're jumping into a place where they can make better sense of. So those are really therapeutic prism applications. Those are compensatory prism applications. Therapeutic prism, where learning takes place, that's where the real power is, because that literally forces the brain to have to take signals from the eyes and from the body and make better sense of them. So we use a lot of what we call yoked prism, which basically moves the visual world to a new position. So let's say somebody has a visual midline shift to the left, and we can measure this based off of trauma that occurred. We can literally move their midline back to their body midline so that their sense of self and space is coincident with what their body and vision is telling them. There's prism that can make a target go to a different position, and you're throwing beanbags at it or doing eye hand work or visually guided fine motor work so that you're literally establishing new pathways that respond to this altered sense or perception of space. I think what has gotten so much attention with prism lately is prism as a quick fix for many, let's just call them brain injuries. And the most common type is something called microprism, or small amounts of base in prism, which moves the world out. So we've talked a few times about trouble converging our eyes, and convergence insufficiency is a potential label or description of a challenging area in space. If it's hard to converge the eyes, if we make prism go move the world out, you don't have to converge your eyes as much. So if it's a large amount, that's a crutch that does the work for you. You then adapt to that. You need a strong amount to maintain that same clarity and go down this vicious cycle where it keeps increasing. But many cases, a really, really small amount gives a little bit of help that can go a very long way in terms of immediate relief of eye strain or fatigue or symptoms with up close. And my method of practice is always, if there's something we can do immediately to improve comfort and to make somebody happier, always that's the first path to take. But then we want to figure out what's permanent, what's not just a short-term solution. But you know, prism can be really effective at allowing for better use of the eyes together as a team, better balance. You know, a lot of kids who have a tendency to walk on their toes, or are called toe walkers. You know, there's structurally, there's a lot of things that don't make a lot of sense about, you know, maybe their calves are too tight or their hamstrings are overdeveloped, which is bizarre to think about. But if you think about it from a visual standpoint, if they're esophoric in posture, meaning they're overly converging, they're perceiving things closer in space than where they are, their body's compensating for what their inability to kind of touch the world visually. And very often they're leaning forward because they can't allow their visual system to open up and take in periphery. You can prescribe the right type of prism, oftentimes base down prism that moves the world up, that can literally improve gait and balance and can allow somebody to be more flat-footed. Or alternatively, somebody who is exotropic, whose eyes drift out more or have a tendency to perceive things farther back in space than where they're located, maybe they're walking with their feet outward a little bit and they're kind of leaning back as they're having to balance the world because vision's not giving balance this way. You can have base up that brings the world down, and then they're now walking more flat-footed as well. So prism is just a tool, but it's a tool that can dramatically influence navigating through space, ambulation, processing information. We see a lot of kids who are on the autism spectrum who literally can't maintain fixation on anything. And then the right type of prism in the right direction and with the right amount literally opens up their world, and they're shifting neurologically their brain to more ambient peripheral visual processing and less focal, less central, like they're looking through tunnel vision. And that alone is almost like one of my mentors calls it a 2x4 to the brain to say, wake up, pay attention to vision. And that's a wonderful way to allow somebody to function so much more efficiently if in fact they fit the profile for that to be beneficial.
One of the questions I have about prism lenses, and I had never thought about the use of prism lenses for some of the descriptions that you just brought to the table, but how often, if someone gets prism lenses, how often should they be reassessed, or what should they expect in terms of how long they will need them?
So I think if we're talking about prism that's therapeutic and hopefully helping allow learning to take place, adaptation is a real thing and does happen. So I would say, absolutely ask the doctor prescribing it. When should I come back? When should we fine tune this? If in fact there's allowing learning, the benefit of those should decrease because we should be relying on our brain's ability to understand what it feels like, looks like, and the depth that it occurs by now using our eyes more efficiently. And so maybe less prism amount is needed, or maybe a different direction is needed. So I would say at least every year, probably sooner, to just reevaluate. There are some types of prism where I've seen a lot of patients who have difficulty focusing, and both cognitively and visually, and they find that they are so much more effective in a cubicle in the corner of the library or like in a closet because they can block out all peripheral distraction. You know, they would maybe benefit from a prism setup that brings the world down. And maybe it's a small amount, but it's enough that it stimulates accommodation, the inside muscles of the eyes, and it stimulates focal processing. And so maybe that would be something that stays at a similar level indefinitely or for a long amount of time, but we should still be following up to make sure that we're getting the weakest amount that's the most balanced, that provides the most improvement. And that's kind of my method of practice with every type of lens, whether it's glasses, prism, filters, tints. We don't want to be relying on them. We want to have the least amount possible to give the most improvement. And I always joke about 20 happy rather than 20/20. Not everybody has to see the same. Not everybody has to view the world the same. But we want to get to a place where we're able to be balanced both at near and at far and able to do as much as we can with as little amount of help as we can.
I like the idea that prisms are not a band-aid masking an issue, that they can be therapeutic in helping address the issues, which I think a lot of patients have a misconception about when it comes to prisms. In the interest of time, there are two topics that I know that we could probably have an entire second part two episode to this podcast, but I want to first talk about issues with screen time and what that's doing to our vision and for our patients. So can you talk a little bit about what the difficulty behind that is and how we manage that?
Yes. How many, should we make this like a couple minute response?
A couple minute, because you know what? I have a really good feeling that if you are willing to come back on, we can definitely do a part two just on screen time, because we have so many people that contact and ask about this, including patients. But let's do a general overview, and then I want to get into your tool a little bit towards the end here that you can give to patients.
Absolutely. And it would be my pleasure to come on as much as you guys would like to have me, as long as I'm not boring people and over talking.
Might have to book out for 2024, right?
No. You're now in the circle of trust. We'll do it tomorrow. We're good. I would say the key with, so screens really are the new pandemic. And as silly as that sounds, I mean, I don't want to sound like an old man sitting on my porch being like, oh, back in my day. And I'm like you guys, I'm young as well. We're all in our early 20s, right? I think it's important to recognize that screen use has been on the incline for decades. That's nothing new. And from a communication standpoint, from technology, from social interaction, but what changed the last few years is screen time was catapulted into the classroom for learning for kids and into the workplace for all of us with virtual working and the world that we were in. And we now have data to support what we're seeing with children, the negative impact it's having on cognitive development, emotional development, social development, and of course, vision development. But for most of us, you know, screens taking over the classroom and the workplace and shopping and dating and even conversing with our neighbor, it's creating these symptoms that, you know, like dizziness, eye strain, blurred vision, environmentally induced nearsightedness, dryness, disrupted sleep and circadian rhythms. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So much of this is it's new stress that when we don't have the tools in place to meet the demands from stress, we either adapt or we avoid. But no one's avoiding screens. And, you know, when we don't have the tools in place, we find ways to compensate. And so when those compensatory mechanisms are the root cause of so many of these vision problems, because we're not visually ready to be staring at screens. Do you know the average American spends 7 hours and 4 minutes on a screen per day? And that's average, which means like many of us well over that. That's nuts.
I think I'm well over that.
Probably. We probably all are. But if you can think about what our visual system is intended for, it's to navigate our three-dimensional world. It's to guide movement. It's not to meant to be staring at screens all day long. And so even just the eye movements that are necessary to be doing what we're doing now, staring at this artificial plane, compared to reading a page on a book that's three-dimensional, there's more eye movements on the screen. They're more sporadic. They're less organized. There's a different convergence and focusing demand. The light that our brain has to filter and process. I mean, blue light has gotten all of the attention in the last couple years. I've been joking. It's kind of like the new gluten, where everyone's just talking about blue light instead of gluten, and they're dating each other at the prom right now. So blue light's not bad for us. Blue light is needed to maintain appropriate mood, circadian rhythms, for happiness even, and blue light we need outside from the sun. But artificial blue light that's blasted to our eyes and our brain for 7 hours and 4 minutes plus per day, we now have compelling evidence that that is a major disruptor of circadian rhythms, which leads to metabolic dysfunction and even some cancers, because we have these specialized receptors in the back of our eye and our retina that's sole purpose is to respond to light. And they trigger the sleep-wake signaling that occurs that allows our brain to secrete melatonin, which allows us to go to sleep. But if that's constantly triggered and we're secreting and we're saying you're awake, you're alert all day long, then by the time it's time to go to bed at night, you literally can't shut down your brain. On top of that, we have dryness and computer vision syndrome. That's now an ICD-10 diagnosis that wasn't even around not too long ago, because when we're on a screen, The average person blinks 15 times a minute. When we're on a screen, it goes to 3 to 5 times a minute. You're literally blinking less. Your own tears are not dispersed over your cornea in the same consistency they were. That sends a signal to your eyes and your brain to release more tears. And then they come out in a more watery fashion. The aqueous layer comes on full speed. And then the mucin layer, the protective layer, is slower and less. And then that allows for your own tears to evaporate quickly and drain faster, which leads to inflammation. And then we have this whole inflammatory response just from being on a screen. And then myopia, I could talk to you about for hours, but environment and genetics play a role. Genetics we can't really control. Environment we can control. And if this is the problem and the muscles themselves can't disengage and are clenched, and then we look far away, far away is blurry because of all the stress at near. Most eye doctors treat the symptom. Here's glasses for far away. That becomes your new normal. You then adapt to something stronger to maintain the same clarity. When if you just look for the problem up close, we know how to fix the problem, and that distance blur symptom goes away. And right now, if last thing about screens, and I'll stop talking. If two individuals were to have a child right now and both individuals were nearsighted, their child has a 1 in 2 chance of being nearsighted. If one parent is, a 1 in 3 chance. And if neither parent is, a 1 in 4 chance. And that's because of the environment that our kids are now living in is very different than when we were all kids, when our parents had to drag us in from being outside because we were playing in the streets and playing ball and in the woods. We're now having parents having to drag their kids outside to get away from technology and screens and social media and all the tech that we're doing in our basements. That's creating this entire new generation of nearsighted individuals, where it's estimated that by 2050, 50% of the world will be nearsighted. And literally screens are a huge reason for all of this. So there's a lot out there that we can do to be more mindful. I mean, we can take breaks like the 20-20-20 rule, which I've been preaching wherever I can, which is not more than 20 minutes on the screen without taking a break for at least 20 seconds and looking at something 20 feet away, essentially giving yourself vision breaks. This gives everyone an excuse to get as big of a monitor as possible and put it as far away as possible. We should reduce glare. We should try and, reduce ambient room lighting, avoid the harsh lighting that's really too bright and rely on natural lighting when we can. There's certain exercises we can do, but then there's also a program that we developed called Screen Fit that is has exceeded all expectations as a revolutionary online vision training program designed to minimize the damage screens has on vision, reduce symptoms, and promote healthy visual habits. So it's essentially a program that it's one new lesson a day. Each lesson should take 10 to 15 minutes to complete. There's 30 lessons. If you're doing it 5 days a week, that's 6 weeks of programming. And we actually have two different courses. And we've taken into account the fact that this is supposed to be done on screens, and we're using screen time to treat screen time, which seems completely counterintuitive. But we have these really short, powerful, interactive videos that eliminate the amount of time that the user spends on the screen and then goes through and does the exercises. You don't need any equipment. You just need something that can allow you to see the programming. Our beta test group was, I think I mentioned you guys, we had our youngest patient was 5 who did it, and our oldest was 89. And literally every single person in the beta test group saw a reduction in symptoms, some a complete resolution of symptoms. And now this is becoming an animal that many people are going to start hearing about because it's going into a very large government agency that's mandating this for all its employees. We have a bunch of big companies doing using this as a way to just promote productivity in the workplace and to not let screens be as damaging moving forward. But for some people, it's enough to really fine-tune things and help establish the right foundation to thrive in this digital world we're in. And then for many, it helps, but office-based vision therapy and individualized treatment is absolutely 100% still the gold standard and always will be. If you have an opportunity, get an evaluation first before you're able to, you do screen fit, but if it's the type of thing that you say, I want to get in better shape and do sit-ups, air squats, and push-ups at home and have it be a little bit programmed so that I can start moving in the right direction, screen fit's a great, great solution to that. And so we do have a code for all your listeners, Talk Dizzy, that will give everybody 10% off of the enrollment, and it's on www.screenfit.com.
Now, let me ask real quick, if you are having symptoms, what kind of symptoms could people be having that they would benefit from this program? So symptoms that somebody is having that they could benefit from, and is there anybody where it's contraindicated that they participate in ScreenFit?
Great question. So I think the main signs would be heavy, tired, dry eyes, headaches or eye strain staring at screens, reduced productivity as the day goes on, can't wait to shut down your monitor after all the back-to-back Zoom meetings because you're literally like, get this away from me. But then also blurred vision, dry eyes, irritation there. So I think those are all signs to say this at a minimum would help some. For somebody who's seeing double or who has an eye turn or lazy eye or who in general, you know, even just looking at a screen and having the brightness on, it's like, oh my gosh, sensory overload, get this away from me. I would argue that there's benefit of this, but I would say don't start with it. You know, let's first see a neurooptometrist and let's look at tints or filters or the right types of glasses to help with that. But other than that, I mean, it's designed to really not embed any bad habits. A lot of the work is done monocularly, one eye at a time, so that we can equalize skills and make sure that both are open, neither one's taken over. A lot of people will find that, you know, when it's seeing how close they can focus and then they're looking at that for 5 seconds and far into the distance for 5 seconds, then here, near, and far, and going back and forth, they'll notice, wow, I can actually focus a lot closer with my right eye than I can with my left eye. And yet I had no idea about that. So you're doing a lot more work on the left side to equalize it. So when both eyes are open, your brain's not having a choice over which eye to use because it's processing both simultaneously. Helpful?
Yeah, it was very helpful. So essentially for our audience, 10 less minutes on social media and 10 more minutes on screen fit. At least that's what I'm going to take away from this because I think even I could benefit from it. Dr. Applebaum, it was great to have you on the show today. I know there's more topics to cover. Again, jokingly, but not jokingly, maybe coming up we can have you back on the show because I have a feeling we're going to get even more questions related to vision and what we can do to help ourselves, not only if we have vestibular dysfunction, but just in general. So thank you so much for coming on. Where can our audience find you? ScreenFit.com, but also your Instagram, perhaps?
Absolutely. I will share those, but I want to thank you both for being so open, putting your knowledge out there. I mean, those who experience dizziness are so lost, as you know, and have no idea where to turn. And your content is amazing. And you do a perfect marriage of actually clinically what's going on with language that people can digest. But then you give examples and demonstrations. And I've passed your social media account on to several other eye doctors who are like, oh, okay. When I described that, didn't make sense. But when you guys described it, it made a ton of sense. So thank you for that. So for me, my practice is going to be rebranded, renamed, re-everything at the end of this month. So the new website is myvisionfirst.com. And so the practice is going to be called Vision First, but it's under the premise of, you know, when healthcare has let you down and when you've been to all these doctors and when you have all these symptoms, you need to be putting your vision first in terms of opening up doors and opportunities for life. So right now it's active site, but there's just kind of a landing page, and that'll be fully updated by the end of the month. And then my social media is Dr. Bryce Applebaum. So DrBryceAppelbaum. We spell it E-L, not L-E, because we try to make life difficult for everybody. And I can thank my ancestors for that. But those are the main ones. And feel free to always reach out. We have a really great team here who answers every question, every inquiry. It's a lot easier if you call or email the office, because just as you guys know, online, it's not always as easy to communicate as well as we should, but always there to provide help and help connect to the right types of doctors if anyone needs help. And of course, happy to see anybody and help in any way I can too.
Well, thank you so much. We will definitely be roping you into another episode. And until then, we'll talk again soon. Thank you.
I would love to. I'm in.
The information on this podcast is not intended to replace the care provided by your qualified health professional or to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on Talk Dizzy to Me. Please contact us at Balancing Act Rehab if you think you could benefit from vestibular therapy.